Good morning. Today's reading is taken from Mark chapter 8, from verses 27 to 38. Peter declares that Jesus is the Messiah. Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked them, "Who do people say I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Peter answered, "You are the Messiah." Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. "Get behind me, Satan," he said. "You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." Then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world, yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of them when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
It won't come as any great surprise to you that I'm constantly being recognized. I'm surprised at the look on all of your faces there. When I'm out and about, you know, people recognize me. They come up to me and they say they know who I am. The problem is that it's always students that I used to teach. And the problem is that the spotty teenagers that I remember are now in their 20s and increasingly in their 30s. And it hasn't happened yet, but potentially it could be in their 40s. And I don't recognize them. And it gets very awkward and very embarrassing as they try and explain who they are, and I still don't realize. There was one time, a long time ago, when I got recognized, and I wish I hadn't been. I'd arranged to play squash with a couple of friends of mine. And I turned up at the sports center, and I walked in, and the lady at reception, before I'd said anything, or even said why I was there, she said, you can go through to court number 4 or whatever it was. I was a bit taken aback by this, and I went through, and my friends were already there, and I said, "This is what's just happened." And they laughed, and they said, "Well, what we did is we said, if a tall, lanky bloke with a big nose comes in, tell him we're on court number 4. Actually, there's another anecdote that's perhaps more relevant to our topic this morning. When our daughter, our eldest daughter, was very young, we would take her along to church, and as good Christian parents, we would tell her why we went to church and what we were there for. And we were there to meet Jesus. And one time we went on a church weekend away with the church we were at the time. And we walked in, and the meeting was already in progress. And someone, a good friend of ours actually, was at the front leading the meeting. And she turned to us and she said, "Is that Jesus?" We've had great fun over the years reminding this friend of ours about that incident. But today we're looking at who is Jesus? Who is he? And we want to look at the real Jesus from our passage today. So we're in Mark chapter 8, and I hope you've all got your Bibles open in front of you. It's one of those rare occasions when you go to a meeting and someone says, please get your phones out. But do that, have your phones open or your good old-fashioned hard copies if that's what you've got. And the reading we just had, let's just remind ourselves of the first couple of verses. Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked them, who do people say I am? They replied, some say John the Baptist, others Elijah, and still others one of the prophets. Who do people say I am? You know, it was common at the time, as we can see from this passage, that people were speculating about who Jesus was. John the Baptist had caused quite a stir, and people were saying, well, it's John the Baptist again, or one like him. Some were saying it was Elijah, because that was something that was expected, that one like Elijah, or in some people's minds, actually Elijah himself, was going to come again, come back to earth. And others were saying, well, it's one of the other prophets. They've come back amongst us. You know, this idea is still very common today. Misconceptions about who Jesus is. You know, there are countless versions of who people think that Jesus is. It was popular a while ago, and it's been mainly debunked, really, thankfully, and quite rightly. You know, some would say that Jesus was just a myth, something invented by the early church. Some would say that, yeah, he was a man. He was just a man. A man that lived, a historical figure. Perhaps we can learn something from him, but he was just a man. Some would say, particularly followers of Islam, that he was a prophet. We'd recognize him as such. He was a prophet sent from God, but that's the end of the story. But you know what? I think in the world in which we live today, for most people, they just don't care. They're not interested. He's of no significance or importance to them whatsoever. And this will always be the case. In fact, the Bible makes that quite clear that this will be the case. For many people, they're not interested in Jesus. They're not interested in what he has to say. And that's why, in many ways, Jesus' second question is much more important. Who do you say I am? Having asked the disciples what other people are saying, he then turns it to them. He makes it personal. Who do you say I am? You know, this is probably the most important question that we all must answer. Who do you say that Jesus is? In our final accounting, when we stand before God, this will be the most important question. The issues of how we've lived, the things that we've done, our sin, in many ways are subservient to this one question. Well, you might think, well, surely that's what the final judgment is about. We're being judged for our sin, and you're right. But you see, we've all sinned, and the Bible tells us that we've all fallen short of God's standards. None of us can argue our case before God. None of us can stand there, however intelligent and clever we are, we think we are, none of us can argue our case before God. You know, it's like arguing with someone standing on top of a ladder about who is closest to the sun. Really doesn't make any difference, does it? Well, maybe they are, but in the grand scheme of things, you're equidistant from the sun. It makes no difference. We're all so far short. But then the key question becomes this question. Who do you say that Jesus is? And Peter's answer is incredibly profound. You know, I think we often fail to see just how significant his response is. The word Messiah is derived from the Hebrew, and the word Christ, which has the same meaning, is derived from the Greek. But they're equivalent terms. We often think of Christ as being Jesus' surname, don't we? Jesus Christ, you know, that was his surname. But it's not the case. It was a title just like Messiah. And both of them mean anointed one, chosen one. In Old Testament times, if someone was going to become king, if they were chosen to become king, they would be anointed for that role. Similarly with the high priest and with many other important offices. When someone was chosen to fulfill a specific role, they were anointed. And so we get these words, Messiah and Christ, which means anointed one, one chosen by God to fulfill a particular purpose. But to even further understand what's happening here and the significance of it, we need to try and put ourselves in the shoes of Peter, a first century Jew. He would have grown up listening to words like this from Genesis. And I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and hers. He will crush your head, and you will strike his heel. Right from the beginning of our Bibles, a figure that was to come, that was going to change things, was spoken about, was pointed to. Further on in Genesis, the scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he to whom it belongs shall come, and the obedience of the nations shall be his. In Samuel, we read, when your days are over, and you rest with your ancestors, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, your own flesh and blood, and I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name. And I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Now you may recognize those words and realize that they were fulfilled in the life of Solomon. But there's a further fulfillment, particularly in that last phrase, that I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. The Old Testament consistently and persistently points to one who was to come and put things right. In the Psalms, we read, sacrifice and offering you did not desire, but my ears you have opened. Burnt offerings and sin offerings you did not require. Then I said, here I am, I have come. It is written about me in the scroll. I desire to do your will, my God. Your law is within my heart. One being spoken of there, prophesied of there, whose name is written about in the scroll, who is predicted and anticipated and waited for. You know, we use the phrase in English, don't you? I could stand here all day and quote these. But do you know what? I genuinely think I literally could stand here all day and read to you references in the Old Testament that point to a Messiah figure. And this was the context in which Peter spoke to Jesus. He didn't say it lightly. It wasn't just a glib way of making his teacher feel a bit better. Peter knew the significance of it. Some of these scriptures he would have known by heart. And yet he still turns to Jesus and said, you are this Messiah. You are this figure that the whole of human history so far has been waiting for. We too need to understand this. It's really important. One of my mantras over recent years, and you may have noticed it and spotted it, has become the simplicity of faith. I've been struck by that and how important that is, that we don't overcomplicate it. We don't need a master's degree to be a Christian. But you know, here is one piece of doctrine that we must understand. Jesus is chosen of God to bring about his wonderful plan of salvation. He is that chosen one, that Messiah. He is plan A, and there is no plan B. There is no alternative. He is the only way. Now in verse 30, Jesus says something quite surprising. He says, don't tell anyone. Now context is crucial here. It's often very important to look at the context when we look at scripture so that we don't misinterpret it. We don't want to take this one out of context and think here we've got Jesus telling us not to tell anyone about him. The context here is that the idea of the Messiah at that point in history had been morphed into a political figure. People were looking for more of a warrior leader. They didn't understand what Jesus' mission was going to be. They had no concept of the cross. And Jesus wasn't that. And he didn't want to stir up a movement behind him that was going to come with swords and shields and begin a revolution. That's not what he was about. And so he said to his disciples, don't tell anyone this. Don't make a big thing of this. But he put that right, and he changed that just a short while later. He made it very clear to us after he rose from the dead that it was our job to tell people. That it is our job. It's the church's main mission, is to tell people about this Jesus, about the good news, that he is the Messiah, the chosen one of God who came to put things right. And isn't it interesting that who do you say I am takes on a new emphasis when you think of it like this? Who do you say I am? When you speak out about Jesus, when you declare about him, who do you say he is when you tell other people about it? You know, this week I've had several emails in my inbox that seem just a little bit too timely to ignore. As we think about declaring this good news and telling people, it's something that for many of us, we feel apprehensive about. We feel not equipped and able to do it adequately. And if you feel like that, I can promise you, you're not alone. It's very understandable. We feel apprehensive. We don't feel that we're able to tell people about Jesus. But these emails that I got this week were helping us to do precisely that. So I'm going to do a little plug here. Now, I know it's very small, but the good news is I'm going to ask the guys to put it up on the screen after the service, and I've also got the information so you can come and speak to me. But if you want to just help yourself to be better equipped, and if you're feeling really convicted about that now, then the first one on the screen starts tomorrow. So you could sign up for it. It's First Steps, Sharing Jesus in Your Everyday. It's going to run on a Monday evening on Zoom, all through Lent, and then one Sunday after Lent. It's a free course. You can sign up for it. It's run by somebody that I know. I can strongly recommend it. If you want to do that, then, you know, the option's there. You can do that. The second one is run by London City Mission, another, you know, source that you can rely on. You know, they're going to give you good training. This one's in person, and it's a one-day thing. So if every Monday night for 6 weeks on Zoom doesn't suit you, you can go along for one day, Saturday the 4th of March. The gospel, what is it and how do I share it? And then the third one, also run by London City Mission. If you've got some Muslim friends and you particularly feel convicted that you don't feel able to share the gospel with them, you don't know how to make it relevant to them, then they're putting on something that's specific to Muslim engagement, to be able to share your faith in a way that makes sense to people coming from that background. That's in a few weeks' time on the 17th of June. Again, it's an in-person event in London. There's three things there. They'll be back on the screen at the end of the service, or you can come and just talk to me about it if you're at all interested in any of those things. But back to our passage. Verse 31. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. "Get behind me, Satan," he said. "You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." You know, the thing that I want to emphasize and focus on here is where it says the Son of Man must suffer, and it goes on. That it must happen. Jesus rebukes Peter because he sees Satan in his words. It's quite harsh, isn't it? That he turns to Peter and says, "Get behind me, Satan." Actually, there's a more stark contrast if you look at this episode in Matthew's version. Because after Peter has said that Jesus is the Messiah, he commends him highly. And then it goes straight on in the next couple of verses for Jesus to turn around to Peter, the same person, and say, "Get behind me, Satan." But I think to understand these words, we need to think back to Jesus' temptation. At the beginning of his ministry, when he went out into the desert and he was tempted by Satan. At the source of all those temptations that Jesus faced was Satan trying to get Jesus to avoid the cross, to find another way. "Bow down to me and you can have all this. Turn these rocks into food. Do these things. There's another way, a different way, that doesn't take you to the cross, that doesn't actually solve the problem." And Jesus sees that in the words of Peter. He realized that Peter is trying to take him away, quite innocently, not realizing what he's doing. He's doing it out of a sincere heart. But Jesus realizes what's going on, what's behind those words. You know, Jesus was many things, many wonderful things. He was a great teacher. There's no question about that. Many people who have no faith will look at the teachings of Jesus and learn something from it. We know he was a miracle worker. He did incredible and amazing things, healing people, even raising the dead. He was a good man. In fact, he was a sinless man. He's the only one who's ever walked this earth and lived a perfect life. But Jesus knew that none of that was as important as his mission to go to the cross. That fundamentally was why he had come. And Peter didn't understand this. All he saw was his master talking about dying. And Peter thought, "This isn't right. He's the Messiah, God's chosen one. This can't happen to him." Because he didn't understand what God's plan was, what God's radical, unbelievable plan was. But Jesus knew that the price for sin had to be paid. And God's justice needed to be satisfied. You know, many in the church today have forgotten this, our need for the cross, why it's so important and so significant. We tone down the gravity of our sin. We say, everything's okay. We daren't say that one thing is wrong, that another thing is wrong. We talk about bad decisions and bad judgments and things like that, but we won't turn around and say that this is wrong. We allow that lie that we can define our own right and wrong to permeate our thinking. That's what we're told in the world today, that we can define that for ourselves, what's right and what's wrong. That's our decision. You know, your truth is not my truth. My truth is not your truth. We can define it how we want. We can't say that something's right and something's wrong. But Jesus suffered and died and bore the full weight of our guilt and shame because there was no other way. We diminish what Christ did on the cross when we say that sin isn't significant. God paid an incredible price for us. And he did it because there was no other way. Do you know why Paul talks about the cross being a stumbling block to the Jews? And he says it's foolishness to the Gentiles, but in particular, a stumbling block to the Jews. It's because the Old Testament talks of anyone who is hung on a tree being cursed by God. And so they turn around and they say, well, Jesus was crucified. He was hung on a tree to die. So he can't be the Messiah. He can't be the chosen one of God because clearly he was cursed by God. The Bible says that. But you know, that is the whole point. That is the whole point of the cross. He was cursed, but for our sake. On the Mount of Crucifixion, fountains opened deep and wide. Through the floodgates of God's mercy flowed a vast and gracious tide. Grace and love, like mighty rivers, poured incessant from above, and heaven's peace and perfect justice kissed a guilty world in love. In verse 34, it goes on, then he called the crowd to him, along with his disciples, and said, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. You know, we use this term, don't we? It's found its way into the English language. Bearing your cross, that's my cross to bear. We use it for any hardship that we might encounter in life. Any difficulty that we come across. But that's not how Jesus intended it here. You see, the point here is that we must take up our cross. As Jesus chose to endure the cross and scorn its shame, as Hebrews tells us, so we must choose to own his name and, if necessary, suffer for his name. Bearing your cross is not enduring things that are just part of the normal hardships of this fallen world in which we live. It's not enduring ridicule even, or animosity that we've brought on ourselves because we're just hard people to live with. It's about taking up our cross in his name, owning his name, siding with him, sharing with him in his sufferings. You know, I nearly completely rewrote my sermon this morning, just this morning, because last night I went to see if prison walls could speak, which I know many of you will have seen. The idea of taking up your cross is driven home most powerfully through that performance. And if you haven't seen it, I would strongly recommend it. But nevertheless, the point is that suffering for Christ's name is still a relevant issue for many, many Christians in the world today. We know so little of it in our comfortable lives here in the UK. But for many people, They have to face that decision as a genuine reality. Am I going to take up my cross? Am I going to stand for the name of Christ, knowing that I could lose my job, knowing that I could be taken away and imprisoned and interrogated? It might even cost me my life. That's the reality for many Christians still today. But we can still all take up our cross and choose not to avoid standing up for what we believe, standing up for our Saviour, being recognised and known to be a Christian. Whether we've been a Christian for years, or whether you're just starting on that journey today, it's a decision that we can all consciously make. So I want to encourage you to make that decision today, to take up your cross, to stand with Christ, to own his name, to walk in his footsteps. I'm just going to finish quite simply with the words of verse 35 and 36. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world and yet forfeit their soul?